This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Today's case that I'm going to share with you guys is one that I've been thinking about for about a solid week now since I started researching it. So if you guys are listening to this in real time, we took a week off because we have had a lot of sickness. And of course, now that the week off is done, I'm sick. So I apologize if you hear like a sicky voice, but I promise I'm fine. I'm just like a little congested. I will try not to cough or sneeze in your ears. But I had already done the research or started the research for this case before we took the week off. And so I have been like thinking about it for quite a while. And it's one that is solved, but there's questions about if the right person is in prison. So it's an interesting one. And I'm very curious to hear what your guys' thoughts are.
Okay.
And this case actually came from one of our listeners. Our listener, Emma, from Scotland, suggested this case. And she said, I'm just going to read you her little note that she said, because this is what really like intrigued me to want to cover it. So Emma said, hi there, my name's Emma from Edinburgh, Scotland. I love your podcast, listen to it almost every day, which thank you, Emma.
Thank you, yeah.
I'd love to hear the story of Luke Mitchell and the murder of Jody Jones. Lots of conspiracies around it. He is in prison, but still withholds his innocence. So I just think it's interesting that like somebody from Scotland is saying that, because it's like, you know, obviously, like, I think people around the world have heard this case, but not as much. Yeah. And it seems like people in Scotland are kind of divided of if they think he did it or think he didn't do it. So I'm going to give you guys all the facts and all the details. And then at the end, we can, Andrea and I will kind of discuss what we think after I share everything and then Andrea hears everything. And then I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on either Instagram or Facebook when we post about this case, because I don't know. It's interesting. That's all I'm going to say.
All right.
So Jody Jones was born in 1989 in East Houses in Midlothian, Scotland, to James and Judy Jones. Jody was the youngest of three children. She had a brother and a sister, and she has been described as headstrong but level-headed and a smart child who loved painting and poetry.
Oh, that's cute.
She was especially close with her older sister, Janine, and her mother affectionately called her Wee Mentor, which is just so Scottish. Aww. So
I
cute.
I love Scotland. All of the things.
The Jones family was a working class family with both of her parents working for the Royal Mail, which is the British Postal Service. But in 1998, the Jones family experienced a tragedy when Jody's father, James, took his own life.
Oh, no.
Jody was just 9 years old at the time, and of course, it caused a lot of heartbreak and distress for the family. And after this, Judy stopped working to care for her children.
That's so sad. That's truly so sad.
I know. As a teen, it's reported that Jody rebelled, although I'm not sure how much of it is like rebellion versus just being a teenager, finding yourself, that kind of thing. Like... yeah. But this quote-unquote rebellion is described as her dyeing her hair colors like pink and green, which like maybe it
I still do that
rebellion if like yeah, like, you know, maybe if your mom is saying don't do it and you do it anyway, that could be rebellion. But like I feel like that's just
which is so silly, because it's like Just hair. Like, my mom was like that when I was growing up. Like, you can't dye your hair. You can't do this. I was like, it's just hair. It's going to grow back. It's going to turn back the color it was meant to be. But whatever.
Exactly. It was also reported that she became interested in heavy metal bands like Metallica, which again, I'm like, is that rebellion?
The devil's music.
Yeah. Yeah. And that will come into play, kind of. But it is noted that at just 14 years old, she also had experimented with alcohol and marijuana. So I guess that's a little bit more of like a rebellion.
A little more extreme, also, yeah.
It's kind of just being a teenager, but like I can see how that could be more of described as this like rebellion.
Yeah, because that's more problematic as opposed to like dyeing your hair pink.
Exactly. One other thing that Jodi started doing was that she started dating. And she got into a relationship with a boy named Luke Mitchell, who was just in the grade above her. But at first, actually, and during this whole thing, they were the same age. So they were like both 14.
Okay.
At first, she kept the relationship a secret from her family, which like I get. I've been there.
We've all been
when
there.
When I was around her age, I totally kept relationships a secret and like or didn't tell all the details or things like that.
Yeah, usually not a good sign, though.
No. And she eventually did confide in her older sister, Janine, about the relationship. And Janine told their mother. And after that, Luke actually met the Jones family. They had interacted. And I don't think that they necessarily had any, like, issues with him, per se. But let's talk a little bit about who Luke Mitchell is. Luke Mitchell was born on July 24th, 1988, in New Battle, Midlothian, Scotland. His parents separated when he was 11 years old, and he and his older sibling were raised by their mother, Corinne. As a kid, Luke was described as well-mannered and smart, and he was interested in hobbies like army cadets, horseback riding, and motorbikes.
Okay.
When he was a teenager, he started to adopt a more goth lifestyle. Which, again, is not an indication of anything other than, like, becoming yourself.
Yeah, individualism or whatever. Yeah, it's totally normal for kids to do that.
But Luke started wearing black clothes and growing out his hair. And he also developed an interest in Satanism and Marilyn Manson.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's like...
It's hard.
It is, because it's like... As a parent, like, you don't want your kid listening, your 14-year-old listening to Marilyn Manson. I very much so was listening to Marilyn Manson at 12. but, like, you know, and, like, thinking I was a witch and, you know, doing all this silly stuff. But, like, also it's just, like, most of the time it's harmless.
Yeah. And it's hard because we, like, know, obviously, what happens in this case. So it's easy to be like, that's why. But, like, that's not necessarily why.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not why, but
teachers did say that this kind of started to permeate his schoolwork. So it was definitely kind of something that was becoming more than just his personality. And in particular, his English teacher was concerned about the violence and Satanism references in his essays. And she was so concerned that she referred him to a guidance teacher.
Okay, yeah.
So in one essay, he wrote, quote, just because I am more violent than others and cut myself, does that justify some pompous git of a teacher to refer me to a psychiatrist? Just because I have chosen to follow the teaching of Satan doesn't mean I need psychiatric help.
I mean, I beg to differ, but.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the teachers are doing everything.
Yeah, it's their duty.
Yeah. They were doing everything that they could to. Help.
Yeah.
But he was also known to get into trouble at school often, fighting with classmates and being physically violent. And at one point, he reportedly showed someone at school a knife and told them that he knew the best way to slit someone's throat.
Oh my goodness. See, that's extreme. But that's also attention seeking, too, I feel like.
Yeah. There's definitely more than just, like, obsession with violence, I feel like. In February 2003, Luke and Jodi, who again were both 14 but were one grade apart, started dating. And Luke was Jodi's first serious relationship, and she was smitten. And it's not clear how much Jody's mom knew about Luke, like about all these other things that he was involved in, because they definitely, like, her mom definitely didn't, like, say, no, you can't date him and, like, totally make her go away, because she kind of brought Luke in and met him and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, which honestly is, I mean, in my opinion, is the better route, because if you push them apart, they're where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. No, I agree. So, like, it's better to, like, accept it and bring on it top in of it, and, like, yeah,
supervise
exactly.
It. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But it does seem like some of the same type of things that Luke was interested in were also entering into Jody's life as they started dating. So she also became goth, starting to wear black clothes, and some reports say that she was known to self-harm, although this hasn't been fully confirmed. Additionally, both Luke and Jody were smoking marijuana, and oftentimes doing it on school premises. But Jody seemed to be infatuated with Luke, as she wrote in one diary entry, quote, "I think I am actually in love with Luke. Not in a stupid way. I mean real love. God, I think I would die if he finished with me."
Okay.
I just couldn't. Which I was just like, that's so, like, adorable little 14-year-old love.
Uh-huh. We've all been there, too.
Yeah. But she said, "If I'm crying, he hugs me and strokes my face. He is just so sweet. No matter what he says, I believe him."
Which is, like, obviously that's the type of romance you want, you know, when you're, especially when yeah. you're, like, young and...
Yeah, it's like young and in love. And,
yeah.
Unfortunately, though, unbeknownst to her, he was in another relationship at the same time.
Oh, Lord.
And the other young girl that Luke was dating, who she's been named in, like, one source that I found, but I'm not going to share her name because it's not necessary to the story.
Yeah.
But she also believed that she was in a relationship with Luke and, like, she was the only one and that she was his girlfriend.
Same feelings.
Yeah. And she didn't find out until after Jody's murder that Luke had been cheating on her.
Oh, wow. So she did she not attend the same school, I'm assuming?
No.
We don't know any details. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think she was at the same school. I think she was actually in, like, a different town, not far, but okay. like she wasn't in the same area.
Okay.
In June 2003, Jody's mother learned that she had been doing drugs. So essentially, she grounded her and didn't let her go out with her friends or Luke for a couple of weeks. That lasted until June 30th, when Jody left her home to go hang out with her boyfriend. And she left around 5 p.m. telling her family she was going to see Luke.
I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I just want to veg out on my phone and play a fun game. Recently, I discovered June's Journey, which is a hidden object mystery game, and I am obsessed. I am 3 chapters in, and I cannot put it down.
I've been loving it, too, because not only does it bring out my inner detective, but eventually I'll be able to uncover the mystery behind the case. You play the game as June Parker, a young woman in the 1920s trying to solve her own sister's murder. And the clues that you start finding all point to June's family having some deep, dark secrets.
During the game, you get to create your own estate, which appeals to my inner interior designer. But before we ruin too much for you guys, you have to download June's Journey for yourself. It's free today on iOS and Android devices.
Check out the link to download June's Journey in the show notes of this episode. But later that evening, Jody hadn't come home, and her mom and sister started to worry. And when no one had heard from her or seen her by around 10 p.m., they actually organized a search party to go out and look for her. While Jody had said that she was going to hang out with Luke that evening, he also said that he hadn't heard from her and that she never showed up, and he joined in on the search party. So they were searching through the woods along Rhone Dyke's Path, which is basically this long stretch of woodland, a trail that both her and Luke would often take to each other's houses. So, like, that was kind of the the like shortcut that they took to walk to each other's houses. Cause you know, right. 14, not driving.
Yeah. Find a shortcut. That's right.
But Luke Mitchell led the search party, and at around 10:30 PM, he led them straight to a gap in a tall wall bordering Rondike's path. And he climbed through the gap and found Jody's body. Jody had been stabbed to death, and it is believed that she had been dead for at least a couple of hours. Investigators immediately noted the violence that the crime scene indicated. They said that Jody had died from a, quote, vicious and frenzied attack involving a knife or similar weapon. And they believed that the killer was likely in a, quote, disturbed and extremely angry state. They also noted that Jody's injuries closely resembled Elizabeth Short, a.k.a. the Black Dahlia, which, by the way, we covered her case in episode 138. Mm-hmm. Very, very brutal attack. Very brutal injuries. And they noted how similar Jody's injuries were to Elizabeth Short's. So that'll come back in a little bit.
Like, to the extreme of her being cut in half?
Not fully cut in half. Okay. But she had several cuts, like, on her breasts, on her stomach, different places after she was killed.
Okay.
Yeah. So a forensic psychologist on the case noted that the attack indicated an eruption of anger, saying, quote, it sounds like an argument had taken place. Either someone who was extremely upset has come across Jody, or someone was there with her and there has been a violent dispute. The severity of the killing suggests the motive may have been more personal, but whoever carried this out was angry, upset, and disturbed. At the time of the attack, the person would have been frenzied and very worked up. They would not have been in control, would have completely lost control. With its frenzied nature, it could easily be a spur-of-the-moment reaction, an eruption of anger. So investigators believed that the killer was in their teens or 20s, and that they had local knowledge due to kind of the remoteness of the location where Jody was found.
Right.
They also found the initials LM and JJ, Luke Mitchell and Jody Jones, carved into a tree near the crime scene. I do want to note that it's unclear, like, how fresh this carving was. So this could have been something that was done before, because, again, they took this path back and forth often.
Right. And probably together some of the time.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm kind of picturing them, like, meeting up in the woods and, you know.
Yeah. Let's write our name on this tree.
Exactly. Within 10 days of the discovery of Jody's body, over 1,400 people had been spoken to as either witnesses, persons of interest, or suspects. And this included 570 people in nearby homes during door-to-door inquiries and 839 motorists who were in the area on the 30th.
Wow.
There were several suspects that we will talk about in a little bit. Or not suspects, sorry, witnesses. So they did get some witness accounts from all of these inquiries.
Okay.
But investigators were quick to identify their main suspect, Luke Mitchell.
Mm-hmm.
He was initially questioned as a witness, but he quickly became the main suspect in the investigation. With suspicion starting to fall on Mitchell, school authorities were concerned for his safety and tried to prevent his return to school, but they couldn't stop him from coming back. And just 2 months later, he ended up getting suspended after objecting to being separated from his classmates. Some of the things we talked about earlier led to more suspicion falling on Luke, especially in the media. So things like his taste in music, his fascination with Satanism and Marilyn Manson, things like that. Photos of his school books that had phrases like Satan Master, lead us into hell, and I offer my flesh, blood, and soul to the Dark Lord of Hell. So like school books with these phrases written on them were shown in the press, and the media was really painting him as like a Satanist who had sacrificed his girlfriend, talking about his goth lifestyle, his violence, fascination with weapons, things like that. Once Mitchell became a suspect, his home was searched, and in his room, they found more evidence that continued to paint this narrative of him. This included a copy of The Golden Age of Grotesque by Marilyn Manson, which he had purchased 2 days after the murder. And they also found the short film Dopplers, in which paintings by Manson depict the Black Dahlia's body after she was murdered.
Okay.
It was also determined that at the time of the murder in 2003, Manson had a Golden Age of the Grotesque exhibition on his website that, again, featured images depicting the mutilation and murder of the Black Dahlia.
Oof.
So while Luke Mitchell was quickly named the main suspect in the case, the investigation spanned 10 months before an arrest was actually made. But in April 2004, then 15-year-old Luke Mitchell was arrested on charges of murder, possession of a knife or knives in public places, and supplying cannabis. Mitchell maintained that he had nothing to do with the murder, claiming that he was at home cooking dinner at the time that it took place.
Okay. Did he have an alibi, like an eyewitness alibi?
He did not.
Convenient.
Yeah. So he was maintaining his innocence, so he went to trial at the High Court of Justiciary in Edinburgh. So we're going to go through both the prosecution and defense's cases during the trial.
Okay.
First, we'll discuss the confirmed version of events that led to Jodie's murder. So determined by forensic evidence, it is believed that the perpetrator, obviously believed to be Mitchell,
right,
punched Jodie in the face several times and then attempted to strangle her with his hands. Jeez. She fell to her knees, and at that point, he began to use the knife, severing a major artery in her neck that led her to bleed out. Jodie was then slashed 20 times. Her clothes were removed for her pants to bind up her body. Then he stabbed her in the abdomen, breasts, and mouth and slit her eyeballs.
Oh my God. That is so brutal.
Absolutely horrific. So the prosecution alleged that Mitchell had met up with Jodie on the evening of June 30th, that they had gotten into an argument, and that it had turned violent. He then killed her with a knife that he was known to carry around and then left her body to go home and pretend that he never met up with her. The biggest piece of evidence against Mitchell was that knife.
Okay, I was going to ask, where is the knife?
So they never found the knife, but he was known to carry around this knife regularly. And after the murder, it mysteriously had gone missing. So he couldn't account for where it was. He claimed he lost it, but the prosecution alleged that he had disposed of it after the murder.
Yeah.
The pouch for this missing knife was found at Mitchell's home. And on it, he had carved JJ, Jodie's initials, and then 1989 to 2003, her birth and death. And then a quote from the lead singer of Nirvana, Jodie's favorite band, that said, "The finest day I ever had was when tomorrow never came." So prosecutors alleged that he had carved this into the pouch with the knife after the murder, but before he disposed of the weapon.
Okay.
Another key piece of evidence was that a camouflaged coat that Mitchell was known to wear regularly had disappeared as well. So several witnesses testified that they saw him wearing that coat often, and he was even seen wearing it on the evening that the murder happened. But the jacket was nowhere in his house, and again, he claimed that he had lost it.
It's not looking good, brother.
Yeah, what are the odds that you lost two important pieces of evidence in a murder case?
If you went into a frenzied rage and murdered somebody wearing that jacket, there's going to be an insurmountable amount of blood. I think that's a double entendre or something. But yeah, like that would make all the sense in the world why both those things are missing.
Yeah, and a neighbor of the Mitchells testified for the prosecution, saying that on the night of the murder, they had seen Mitchell's mother, Corinne, burning items in her garden.
No, Girl.
So the prosecution alleged that this was her burning evidence, likely that coat. However, Corinne claimed that she was burning pampas grass that night and not any other items. And unfortunately, no forensic evidence was able to be recovered from the like incinerator where it was all burned.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, months after the murder, Corinne bought a replacement coat and knife for Mitchell for Christmas. And she actually denied the existence of the previous coat, saying like, no, this is the only coat, even though so many witnesses said like, no, he was known to wear this jacket a lot.
Yeah.
But Mitchell himself was never able to explain the disappearance of the coat and the knife.
Now, to go back, sorry, to backpedal a little bit, when you said that the prosecution thought that he had carved the initials and the quote into the pouch after the fact with the knife, wouldn't there be like blood evidence?
Maybe? There might be, unless he cleaned the knife off.
True.
But also I was like, he could have done that with another knife.
With anything. Like, yeah, literally.
Yeah. So
just trying
that
to
was
make
just
it sound
what,
like,
what prosecutors believed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one witness testified for the prosecution that she had seen a man resembling Mitchell near the murder scene on the night of the murder. The man she saw was wearing a khaki green hip-length jacket that matched the description of that camouflage jacket he was known to have and was seen wearing the night of the murder by others. Phone records also indicated that Mitchell had called to a speaking clock service, like, you know, one that tells you, like, this is what time it is. Which, that brought me back so much. Like, I remember used to do that from, like, our home phone before everybody had cell phones. Just, like, look at the time.
Yeah.
But he called to that at 4:54 p.m., which was right before when Jody left to go meet up with him. So this challenged his alibi of being at home, because if he had been home, why wouldn't he just look at a clock?
Yeah. I was thinking, like, I remember when we used to call that number back in the day, it would be to stop your phone from ringing at home because your friend or your boyfriend or whoever was calling you. So it would be like getting another call in. So that's where my mind went, was like trying to block a call from being heard or something. But
yeah, that's interesting. That's a good point too.
Yeah.
But the prosecution was saying this shows he wasn't at home, because if he was at home, he could have just looked at a clock.
True. Very true.
When asked about this, Mitchell couldn't give any explanation. Another witness testified that they saw people matching Mitchell and Jones on that path around the time that they had agreed to meet up. The next aspect that the prosecution focused on was how quickly Mitchell found Jody's body during the search.
Yeah, that was my thing. Is like, I mean, it sounds like they searched for a couple hours before that, but still, it was just so...
It was quick, and it was...
Straight to it.
Yeah, he went straight to it. So witnesses who were also part of the search party described how he had taken them straight to the gap in the wall as they walked along that path. And again, they're walking along this path searching, and he goes off to this gap in the wall, goes through it, and that's where her body is. So it's not like it was just on the path. He went off the path.
Yeah, where like it's hidden, so you wouldn't necessarily know that anything would be there, including the gap. But also they take that route so frequently, he would know the gap was there. But why search there? I don't know.
Yeah. And he, like, if, you know, if he didn't know her body was there, he could have been like, oh, wait, we sometimes go in here. Let me go over here. So that is a possibility.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. People who were part of the search party said that once he went through the gap, he immediately looked to the left, exactly where Jody's body was. And he seemed to be able to easily tell that it was a body despite the darkness and the relatively thick woodland surrounding the area.
So he like alerted everyone, like, there's her body.
Yeah, exactly. He was also able to later tell police the type of tree her body was found under, even though it was dark when they found her. Which again, that could be that he knew that area, but the prosecution is bringing everything they can to like try to prove that he knew what he was looking for.
Right.
Now, to explain this, Mitchell had claimed that his dog, who was searching with him, was trained to track, and that the dog had stopped at the gap, sniffed, and basically indicated to go that there was something there. And so that's why he climbed through it.
Okay. Okay. Fair. Because dogs are going to, if especially like something like that, like a someone's body who there's large amounts of blood, I assume.
Yeah.
They're gonna sniff it out. But also he's not like a cadaver dog.
He's not
dog.
A cadaver dog. Like, yeah, even so, if he's trained to find stuff, unless he's like an actual cadaver dog, I don't know.
Not necessarily going to be like, alert, alert, like body to the left, you know?
Exactly. And members of the search party disputed this account and said that Mitchell had gone straight to the gap without being notified or led by the dog. So if the dog did alert, it was not an obvious alert to like others in the search party, which again, right, you know, maybe Mitchell knew his dog well and knew what that meant. But people in the search party were like, no, the dog didn't indicate.
Yeah, it's just too much of a gray area for me.
I agree. They also reported that when Jody's body was found, Mitchell did not appear to show any emotion or surprise, unlike other search party members who became upset and hysterical.
Yeah. I mean, to see that poor young girl in that condition, number one, to find out that she is deceased, and then number two, to see how brutally she has been attacked. Now, devil's advocate, we could say he's desensitized because of what he's witnessed from Marilyn Manson and, you know, whatever else he's looked on the internet. But that's your girlfriend, bro. Like, have some emotion a little bit, even if it's shock, like, you know, like, oh my God, like, you know, maybe you're not.
Yeah. Like, it seems like
bit of tears, but yeah.
The prosecution also pointed to Mitchell's police interviews in which he claimed that he didn't contact Jody when she failed to meet up with him. Because, again, everybody knew that they were going to meet up that night and she just didn't show up. So police were like, why didn't you call her? Why didn't you reach out to her trying to figure out where she was? And he just said that he believed she had met with someone else and had gone off with them. But they pointed how odd this was, given that, quote, these two youngsters had met up every night if they could, and she had only once before failed to keep an arrangement. And again, this was after her being, like, basically grounded for a couple of weeks. So
yeah,
why would you think that she decided to do something else?
Yeah, she wouldn't have just decided to not meet up. But, like, if she got in trouble or something like that. But she would still call and be like, hey, like, what happened?
Yeah, still call and try to find out where she is. Yeah.
Yeah, unless you knew that she wouldn't be available.
Mm-hmm, exactly. They also pointed out contradictory claims that Mitchell made during his interviews, including changing his story to say that he assumed she had been grounded again, like you just said.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently one of her relatives had told him by phone that she was on her way to meet him. Mm-hmm. So the prosecution presented that and said, like you should have known that she was coming to meet you.
Yeah, you did know. I mean, that's what that says. I mean, it's their word against his, but still.
Yeah. And then Mitchell's brother testified for the prosecution. He claimed that night he had been, and just like, not even a trigger warning, just warning that I'm just going to keep going. He had been viewing internet pornography at their home, which was verified by computer records.
Okay.
But he testified that he would only have done that if he believed the house was empty. And he claimed that he did not see Mitchell in the house that night.
Okay.
So he's basically saying, I know I was home because I was watching porn. And I would only do that if I was home alone.
I was home alone. Yeah. Which, thank you.
Yeah. But the brother actually initially supported Mitchell's alibi, claiming in an early police statement that he had seen Mitchell in the kitchen that night. But then during the trial, he testified that he had lied to police during that initial statement and that he had discussed with his mother what to tell police in the days after the murder.
Okay, that doesn't look good because now I just like don't know what to believe. I mean,
I think that he was telling the truth at the trial just because I'm sure they grilled into him the fact that this was under oath. Perjury is a thing. You can go to jail if you lie. So to me, it seems like his initial police statement was him trying to cover his brother's ass because he had talked about it with his mom. He didn't know. And then once he actually talked to investigators, police, and like they were like, hey, you actually can't lie because you're going to be under oath, he told the truth.
Right.
That's just my opinion.
Okay, that makes sense. But no, that makes more sense because, like, yeah, I thought the same thing. Like, initially, he'd probably want to try to cover, even if he didn't think his brother was guilty.
Yeah, you
still, just like, want to try to. Oh, this will help.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah. But, yeah, you have a lot more to lose when you're on the stand and you're under oath because, you know, perjury and all that.
Yeah, you can go to jail for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Corinne, Luke's mom, claimed under oath that he had been at home cooking dinner at the time of the murder. So, of course, this goes against the brother because the brother said, no, he wasn't home.
Right.
So the prosecution was trying to discredit Corinne because, you know, it's her word against the brother's technically because they're both under oath. So technically they shouldn't be, either of them shouldn't be lying. But the way they discredited her was pointing out that in October 2003, she had gone with her son Luke to get a tattoo. And at the appointment, she lied that he was 18. He was only 15. But apparently at the appointment, she like said like, oh, yeah, he's 18. And this was confirmed by witnesses from the tattoo parlor.
Okay. Again, it's like if he didn't do what he did or what we think he did, I wouldn't even be like batting an eye really to that because I feel like parents do that, you know, like it's a tattoo, like it's not murder.
Right.
It's a harmless, quote unquote, harmless thing that you just want to like be with your. But also, like, why does she have to lie? Can't you just sign for your kid to get a tattoo?
I know. I had that same thought.
Maybe in Scotland, you have to be 18 to get a tattoo. I don't know their laws, but I know that like here, you can just sign for your kid to get stuff like that.
Yeah.
After a certain age. I think it is 15, but.
Yeah, I think you're right. But yeah, it was just weird, but they were using this to prove like she would lie for her
son.
She's
a liar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So prosecutors said, quote, This demonstrated an unhealthy relationship between Mitchell and his mother and that she was pampering him and lying for him, and that from this, the jury could consider her alibi for her own son to be untrustworthy.
Yeah, and that coupled with the fact that she was, like, mysteriously burning something the night of the murder, that to me is a huge red flag.
And the fact that the brother said we discussed what to tell police, and then he ended up initially lying to police.
Mm-hmm.
So Corinne was actually charged with perjury for lying to provide Mitchell with an alibi, but this perjury charge was later dropped. Prosecutors posited that the source of the fight between Jody and Mitchell could have been her finding out about his other girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So this other girl, again, didn't know that Mitchell was with Jody until news of the murder came out.
Wow.
He allegedly had plans to go away with this girl for 2 weeks, starting just a few days after the murder. So the prosecution alleged that this affair could have been the source of conflict between Jody and Mitchell. They got into a fight, Mitchell turned violent, and then everything happened.
Right.
Now, Mitchell had claimed in police interviews that he hadn't spoken with the other girl in months, but his phone records showed that they spoke regularly. There were 79 calls between the two in the weeks before the murder alone.
Jeez.
One witness testified that on the night of the murder, Mitchell had made a comment to them that Jody couldn't come out that evening, even though this was after the relative called him to tell him that she was on her way. So
yeah,
how would he know that? Prosecution argued that this comment, he commented this because he knew she was already dead.
He already killed her. Right.
Finally, the prosecution pointed out Mitchell's interest in the Black Dahlia case with the evidence like the Marilyn Manson exhibit and the film found at his home. And they pointed to how some of Jody's injuries mimicked some of Elizabeth Short's.
Yeah.
The prosecution stated, and Mitchell confirmed, that after Jody's death, his use of cannabis escalated, with Mitchell estimating that he was going through 600 joints a week.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So
what in the world?
I know. So
that
is excessive. A lot.
Is he just saying that though, or like?
No, I think that they like confirmed this.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Because I was like,
I didn't write this down, but I believe one officer was like, "That is the most I have seen in like my 20-year career."
Yeah, that's a lot. I mean, that's like,
constant,
like being a chain smoker of marijuana,
yeah,
joints.
And you know, some could argue that insane. That was because of grief or whatever, but the prosecution was trying to paint him as like not a drug addict necessarily, but you know, that kind of can paint him in a bad light, especially
and he also could have been, you know, had he done this, he could have been maybe having some regrets, maybe having some guilt, and that was a way to numb that those feelings.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So that was the prosecution's whole case. The defense mainly focused on the lack of physical evidence connecting Mitchell to the murder. So there had been Mitchell's DNA found on Jody's bra, and then her DNA found on his pants. But since they were in a known intimate relationship, it was agreed on by both the prosecution and defense for the DNA to not be discussed at trial.
Yeah, which is insane, because how do you murder someone so violently and have no evidence?
I know, but since they were together, they could basically explain away any DNA. Unless his blood was found, which I don't think it was, because I don't think he was cut at all or anything. Any of his DNA on her can be explained.
Yeah. How did he just like, it's just so crazy, because it's like, how does he not have any of her like blood under his fingernails or like defensive wounds or anything, you know?
That's
like,
true, that's... but I think for defensive wounds, I think it was almost like a blitz attack. Like he just attacked her, flew into this violent rage.
Yeah.
But no pieces of evidence from the murder scene contained any other DNA evidence to connect Mitchell. And like I mentioned earlier as well, there was no forensic evidence found from that incinerator where his mom was burning something that night. So there wasn't any actual real evidence to connect him. They didn't find the knife. They didn't find the coat. No way to actually physically connect him.
Yeah.
And again, Mitchell claimed that his dog had led him to the gap in the wall, and that's how he found Jody so quickly, which may or may not be true, but also, as we kind of mentioned, if they had been there before, he could have easily been like, oh, sometimes we go behind this wall. Let me go check there. That could have been a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, teenagers go behind walls to do things.
Exactly.
You know, kiss or...
Yeah.
Do seances or whatever, you know?
Maybe some other stuff too. Those aren't
maybe
the only
some
two
other
options,
stuff too. Yeah. Nothing else. Only kissing and seances.
That sounds like what you would do behind a wall.
Yeah.
Teenage you behind a wall, either kissing, seances.
Seances, yeah.
But the defense was bringing up the lack of physical evidence, and they also brought up the intense press coverage before the trial, because the media was really like painting Mitchell as this killer that was a Satanist, that was interested in Marilyn Manson. He was goth. He listened to heavy metal, you know, like painting this whole, it's like the satanic panic
Yeah, that's exactly what I was about to say. The satanic panic of like the 70s and the 80s and or 60s, 70s and 80s, I guess.
Yeah, that was definitely happening here.
Yeah. And that, you know, all those things combined don't make you a murderer, though.
Exactly.
I mean,
and it's frustrating that that's what like the media was focused on, because, mm-hmm. you know, that he might be a killer, but that's not an indication that he's a killer.
No. And even just being a Satanist, I mean, that people think devil worshiping and Satanism are not even really one and the same.
Yeah.
You know, like they and, get, you know, that mixed up. But
yeah, and people, you know, you and I would never want to like endorse that, but to each their
no.
own, you know, like people can do what
yeah,
they want.
Yeah.
So that doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, I love the Lord, so I'm against Satan at all costs, but
yeah.
I'm not going to be like, oh, you are a Satanist? Well, you must be a murderer, because that's absurd.
Exactly. And so the media really just took that and ran with it. So at the trial, mm-hmm. the defense was bringing this up and saying, like, he was, you know, even though the jury is supposed to be impartial and not, like, know all of this,
yeah.
they're saying, like, it still obviously was a thing, and
yeah,
that shouldn't
have. We've
seen
it time and time again. And
exactly.
it muddies the cases, and it muddies the evidence, and it muddies the outcome, and it's unfair. I mean, even if he is a murderer, he needs to be tried and charged based on the evidence, even if it's circumstantial, not on what he wears, what mm-hmm. music he listens to, what his interests are.
Exactly.
You know.
And I mean, that's why now there's like gag orders and things like that are more common. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that in the Brian Koberger case in Idaho. They're keeping so much close to the chest because they don't want to influence the jury pool, because that's such a national case now. We would have seen mm-hmm. the same thing had Brian Laundrie been caught before he died.
Yep. Right.
Would they have found an impartial jury? Because it was yeah. all over the country. So
the whole world.
Yeah, yeah. All the world. But so
really,
that was
yeah.
part of the defense's strategy in Mitchell's trial. Okay, so the trial lasted for 42 days, and the jury deliberated for 5 hours over a two-day span. On January 21st, 2005, almost a year and a half after Jody's murder, Luke Mitchell was found guilty. Mm-hmm. He was found guilty on the count of murder and guilty on the count of supplying cannabis. When the verdict was read, Mitchell showed no emotion, which... whenever I hear that, as much as I want to be like, oh, that means they're guilty. I mean, who freaking knows? If you're being sentenced or if you're being found guilty and you didn't do it, you might not show emotion
yeah.
either, because you might just be in like such a state of like disbelief, especially after a 42-day
yeah.
trial.
Yeah, it's just hard for me because he's a child, and I feel like on average, teenagers are very emotional.
That's true.
So to have no reaction is just, it is odd. And I mean, it is odd. Just,
but
it
also,
is.
Also, like,
you know?
His defense could have coached him and
but
said,
it's not
like,
guilt.
You know, like, prepared him for it.
Yeah, showed
said,
no
like,
emotion. Yeah.
Don't get mad. Or, you know, who knows? But, yeah.
Yeah, that's very true, too. Because I'm sure they do. Like, you know, don't get enraged and, you know, flip a table or anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
that's just
going to
make it worse. Because you still are going to get sentenced, and the judge is going to look at, like, everything.
Everything, yeah.
Yeah. But after the verdict was read, the judge addressed Mitchell, saying, quote, "It lies beyond any skill of mine to look into the black depths of your mind. I can only look at what you have done. You have been convicted of a truly evil murder, one of the most appalling crimes that any of us can remember, and you will rightly be regarded as wicked."
Mm-hmm.
On February 11th, 2005, Judge Lord Nemo Smith sentenced Luke Mitchell to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 20 years. At his sentencing, he discussed how Mitchell's use of cannabis likely blurred his understanding of fantasy and reality, and that his relationship with the other young girl was likely the catalyst to his argument with Jody that led to her murder. He also discussed Mitchell's lack of emotion during the entire trial, saying, quote, "It may be that a lack of emotional response made you more readily able to inflict harm on others." So he was kind of saying, referencing, like, you clearly have a very big lack of emotional response to things. So that's likely how you were able to do something so violent to somebody you supposedly loved.
Right.
But Lord Nemo Smith said to Mitchell, quote, and I just want to read this whole thing to you because it was, I just love when judges like.
Rip them a new one.
Yeah,
read them for filth.
Yeah. So he said, what you did was to subject Jody to a horrible death, and one can only hope it was mercifully quick. There must, however, have been a time before she became unconscious when she knew that you, her boyfriend, whom she held in affection and trust, and whom she left joyfully to meet, had turned into a fiend. She still had her life ahead of her, and you snuffed it out. She was loved by her family, and you have left them bereft. The horror of what you have done has changed many lives and will last far beyond any sentence I can pass on you.
So awful. She was so young, so impressionable, just a girl in love with a boy who obviously had a lot of control over her and changed who she was as a person. And, you know, for him to do this extreme thing to her and to see, I mean, she had to have seen him and looked him in the eye at some point while he was
doing this and known what was happening. So Luke Mitchell was sentenced to life in prison and he went to jail. Doesn't end there though, because of course he appealed. After he was sentenced, Marilyn Manson actually spoke out. And he disagreed with the claims that his work had influenced Mitchell to murder Jody. And he blamed Mitchell's lifestyle instead and saying it was, quote, all about his upbringing. Which, like, nobody's blaming. I mean, maybe people were blaming him, but, like, nobody's blaming you and saying, like, you're the one who made him murder. I mean, I'm sure there were people who.
Lots of people blame Marilyn Manson for lots of things. And. Yes, he has an influence, especially for younger, you know, impressionable, non-fully developed minds. But I think it's weird to speak out about it because it's almost like admitting to having some kind of responsibility to it in a way.
Yeah. And he's trying to say, like, no, it was all his upbringing. And it's like, no, I think it was a mix of everything.
It was definitely nature versus nurture. In my opinion, but that's so weird.
I was like, what?
I feel like he's done that before, though. I feel like he's done that. He's had to do that a lot.
Well, yeah, because he doesn't want to, like, he doesn't want his work to be, like, influencing murders, which, like, duh, but.
Yeah.
And it's not just his fault. Like, you know, there's plenty of people who view his work who don't commit murders, but. Yeah, exactly. But Luke Mitchell maintains his innocence to this day.
Well, yeah, he's still eligible for parole.
His first appeal was filed in March 2006 on the grounds that the trial judge should have moved the trial outside of Edinburgh because of the intense amount of press coverage the case received. The prosecution countered this argument, saying that Mitchell's defense had contradicted themselves by claiming that there had been intense press coverage nationally. Because remember, this was part of their defense, talking about the press coverage, and that this wasn't just confined to Edinburgh. But then during the appeal said, oh, well, if you would have moved the trial out of Edinburgh, it would have stopped this possibility of an unfair trial.
Well, that's contradictory.
Good point, right?
Yeah.
So in February 2008, his appeal was heard by the Court of Criminal Appeals in Edinburgh, and in May 2008, his original conviction was upheld by three judges.
Nice.
Mitchell also tried to appeal on how his police interview was conducted because it was done without a supervisor present since he was, you know, a child technically still.
Right.
The judges did agree that he was that the way he was questioned was, quote, outrageous and to be deplored. But they ruled that none of the key pieces of the prosecution's evidence was affected by the conduct in this interview. So they said, therefore, this doesn't indicate that your conviction was unfair.
Okay.
In 2012, a 300-page collection of evidence was delivered to the Scottish Criminal Cases Review Commission, or the SCCRC, and with this, his lawyers launched a new bid to overturn his conviction. This included claims that somebody who looked like Mitchell was the killer, you know, somebody with the same build, same hair color, things like that, and that this person then, because this person was in the area, that's what confused eyewitnesses to say they saw Mitchell. In 2014, the SCCRC did rule that the police breached Mitchell's human rights when they questioned him, but they determined that he was not the victim of a miscarriage of justice. The SCCRC report stated that, quote, there are no grounds to challenge the guilty verdict. In 2019, somebody who's described as an alternative therapist, Dr. Sandra Lean, really kind of started focusing on Mitchell's case and his innocence. She launched a GoFundMe to raise funds for Mitchell, but GoFundMe actually deleted this campaign, saying that it breached their terms of service.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Now, Jody's family has continually criticized Lean for spreading misinformation on the case. They also have criticized her for selling campaign t-shirts with slogans like, open your eyes to the lies and justice for Jody and Luke. Because Lean is trying to say, well, Jody didn't get justice either because her killer's still out there. But Jody's right. family is frustrated with this because they're saying, no, we think that they got the right killer and you need to stop doing this.
Yeah, and like, well, on what grounds? Like, what do we...
Yeah, so we'll kind of talk about some of that here in a second.
Okay.
But in 2021, a documentary that came out is what I think sparked a lot of questions about Mitchell's guilt in the public eye.
Okay.
So this documentary is called Murder in a Small Town, and it included interviews with Mitchell's mother, Corinne, and others. But it was mainly focused on Luke Mitchell's innocence. However, the documentary itself has faced a lot of criticism for what it left out. So in the documentary, they did not once mention Luke's brother's testimony and account that completely contradicted everything that Corinne claimed. They also left out the call to the speaking clock that Luke made, which further debunked his alibi of being at home. And I watched it, and it does bring up some good points, but it also does leave out a lot of simple, clear facts. And if you want to show Corinne's point of view and what she says, that's totally fine. But you also have to show the point of view of Mitchell's brother, of his, you know, what's the right word? Not going against, but his, like, debunking Luke's alibi, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he was saying, no, he was not home.
Yeah.
Because I was doing this other thing. And everyone else is like, okay, he was cooking dinner. And, like, what do you believe?
Like, yeah. There's both accounts. Like, you can't say the mother's more trustworthy than the brother. You know, like, it. And again, they both testified under oath, but it's hard to say. This actually reminded me a lot of the JonBenet Ramsey case, and I believe it was a 2016 documentary that came out with one of the news networks where they really pushed the narrative that her brother did it. And I remember watching that documentary as, like, one of the first things that I watched on that case. And after watching it, I was like, yep, he did it. And then after doing actual research into the case and learning all of the facts, I was like, I don't think so. And it just goes to show how things can be swayed easily in the media based on what information is presented. I mean, same with Madeleine McCann. The first Madeleine McCann thing I watched was the Netflix series. And after watching that, I was like, her parents 100% did it. But then after doing research, same thing, I was like, I don't think so. And now there is a very likely non-relative that is going to hopefully one day be charged with her murder.
Right.
And it's like, you know, media like this can very heavily be influenced based on just simply what they show.
And we're just human beings. Like, our brains will, I mean, you know, we can be easily influenced. It doesn't mean that we're stupid or non-intelligent or anything like that. It just means that we don't know and our brain is trying to make sense of it. And so here we are presented with this very viable, you know,
explanation
sequence
for
of events.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, yeah, that fits. Like, I remember when the JonBenet Ramsey thing came out and me and my sisters watched it together, and I'm pretty sure they were both like, it was the brother. Mm-hmm. It was the brother, you know? And I was like, I've always stood, we know where I stand. If you don't, it's fine. I'm not going to get into it. But I was like, nope. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
I don't think it is, because I was so solid, because I've been hearing about this case my whole life, pretty much.
Right.
And then, yeah, but I've been, like, I thought it, Madeline Kane, I thought it was her parents. Yeah. I thought it was her parents forever.
And then
you know?
When we did our episode on it, and, like, when I researched our episode on it, that's when I changed my mind. But had I only watched that documentary, that's what I would have believed. So I think the same thing kind of happened here. And that's why I said, I think this is when a lot of the questions about his guilt in the public eye came out, because it just seems like a lot of people watched this because, you know, in 2021, people are more into true crime, more into watching these types of things. And so that came out and people watched it and were like, oh yeah, he's innocent, without knowing all
I need
of
to
the
watch
facts.
It. I need to watch it, because where I stand right now, I can't imagine changing my mind.
Yeah. You should watch it. It's interesting.
What is it on?
So it was on Channel 5. You can find it on YouTube, because it's a, you know, international Scottish. So if you're not in Scotland, you can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
So yeah, I would recommend you guys watch it, because it's interesting, but also keep in mind, like, all the facts that we went through here, and note, like, what wasn't included.
What's omitted. Yeah. Because I think everyone deserves to share their side of the story, you know?
Yeah,
and
I do
his
too.
Mother, obviously, she's a victim in all of this. To some degree, if she, you know, helped him, whatever.
Yeah.
If not, then, you know, she's very much a victim in all of this. And
yeah,
I mean, I would love to see her perspective.
Yeah. And it's interesting. And the documentary does suggest other suspects. One in particular was a former drug addict who is now no longer alive, but he was allegedly in the vicinity where Jody was murdered. However, and he was also allegedly seen after the murder with scratches on his face.
Okay.
But what the documentary doesn't talk about is the fact that police did look into him during the initial investigation, and they cleared him as a suspect. Not saying police always get it right, but the documentary doesn't mention that he was looked into.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But Murder in a Small Town also implied that members of Jody's family were involved in a cover-up. This is the part that really bothers me, because this led to one of the family members actually being attacked on social media, suggesting that they were involved. And they received a lot of severe criticism from this, because, you know, people are watching this, seeing them say, Luke's innocent, Jody's family's involved, and attacking her family.
Yeah. And on what grounds? Again, it's like, I need some solid evidence. Like, you can't just make these accusations without any backing, because you're just grasping.
Yeah. So after the documentary came out, police came out and confirmed that they had verified the alibis and whereabouts of all of Jody's family members, just as part of a normal investigation. And they said none of them were ever suspects. But still, Jody's family members have been subjected to misinformation and false accusations on social media, as well as, quote, soul-destroying regular abuse from amateur sleuths and supporters of Mitchell.
Yeah.
But like I said, it seems like this documentary is what really fueled a lot of questions about Mitchell's guilt. It does seem like they left out a lot of facts, because if you're to watch it, yes, it does kind of seem like he's innocent. But if some of the facts that were proven at trial were left out, how can you make a definitive conclusion?
That's so annoying, because that's like, okay, I'll just get on there and make a documentary about some other case and just spit out a bunch of information that's not even real. Like,
exactly.
That's just, I mean, I know freedom of speech, like, you know, we're allowed to just say whatever we want to say, but you're going to, you look foolish if you have no proof to back up your claims.
Yeah. And at least say all the facts.
Yeah. Even the ones that maybe don't look your, like, make your case look so good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you look really guilty when you're like, I'm going to leave that out.
Yeah, exactly. But after the release of the documentary, a petition protesting Mitchell's innocence actually garnered 16,000 signatures, but it doesn't seem like anything from this has come. In March 2023, so just over a year ago, Mitchell's lawyers accused police of, quote, failing to carry out forensic tests on samples found on Jody at the time of the murder. Now, Jody's family has declined to comment on these claims, but police have said that a full forensic analysis of all the available evidence was carried out at the time. So Detective Paul Livingstone said, quote, following the discovery of 14-year-old Jody Jones' body on June 30th, 2003, a thorough investigation was conducted by Lothian and Borders Police. Extensive forensic analysis was carried out along with door-to-door inquiries and other investigative techniques, and a full report of the circumstances was submitted. As a result, Luke Mitchell was charged with Jody's murder before being convicted and sentenced in 2005. So they're saying we looked at all the forensic evidence. Did everything.
Due diligence, yeah. I mean, why would they not? Like,
yeah. Exactly.
I mean, like you said, sometimes police don't always do the best investigating, and things do get overlooked. But I mean, if they had evidence, say, like somebody's DNA on her body, like why would they not be like, we have this?
Yeah, exactly. You know? So as Luke Mitchell continues to maintain his innocence, he has a lot of supporters. One relative of Jody criticized these supporters, saying, quote, these supporters are dangerously deluded. The family has always been of the view that the police have the correct person for Jody's murder. His team are just muddying the waters and confusing people with no knowledge of the legal system and how it works. So, Luke Mitchell was moved to Criswell House in Greenock Prison in 2021 in preparation for progression to an open prison, which is basically where prisoners are, like, not locked in cells, but just locked in, like, the larger prison area as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
But he failed some of the tests for this, so it seems like he was not moved further. And then in June 2023, it was revealed that Mitchell had failed two random drug tests.
See?
In April of this year, 2024, it was reported that 34-year-old Luke Mitchell was preparing to apply for parole, with a source close to him saying, quote, he was being prepared for release until he failed a couple of drug tests and was being treated badly by the prison service. But now we think he stands a good chance for parole. So some of his supporters are trying to say that, like, he was taking medication for something and that's why he failed a drug test. And then they were like, now he's going to get more time because he, like,
fail you.
Yeah, no.
If you were prescribed drug, I'm assuming it's illicit drugs,
yes,
like
yes.
Marijuana, heroin, meth, yeah. Whatever. It's being snuck into the prison. But which is like, if you're so close to getting paroled, why are you doing that? You know, yeah. Like.
Exactly. No, it's not looking great. But
yeah,
when news came out that April 2024 would be the earliest he'd be able to apply for parole, one of Jody's relatives said, quote, he is nowhere near ready. He has never admitted his guilt or shown any remorse for Jody's death. Instead, the last few years have been tarred by accusations that have hurt the family and brought further heartache to us. The campaign to have him released has seen Jody and her family's name dragged through the mud. If this man was released back into society, he would be a danger. He has shown nothing but arrogance recently. We will be making a strong representation to the parole board, should he apply, that Luke Mitchell should not be released from prison until he admits his guilt and shows he is sorry for the hurt and grief he caused and remorse for murdering Jody.
First of all, he's never going to admit his guilt.
No.
Never. Because, number one, it makes him look like a fool. Because he has maintained his innocence for 20 years. Yeah. Even if he gets out, he might brag about it. And there might be a rumor. He might slip up and tell one person. But he's never going to publicly admit to his guilt. Mm-mm. Number two, anyone who has shamed her family and tried to drag them through the mud, shame on you. Because even if they did, it was the prosecution. Even if they did send an innocent, quote-unquote, man – innocent man to prison, they just want justice for their child, their loved one.
It's not their fault.
Shame on fucking you for doing that. If that was your family member, you would go to hell and high water and back to do the same damn thing. So that is unreasonable.
Yeah,
unfair and unreasonable.
Agreed. And they said too, kind of going off of what you just said, quote, the campaigners have all but blamed dozens of people for her murder, except the man found guilty in court. If he is let out, it will be the biggest slap in the face to the Jones family after all they've been through.
Yeah. Why don't you guys go out there and investigate? Why don't you find the real person that did this then?
Yeah, exactly.
Because like, blaming her family, that's not the route. No. Okay? That ain't it.
No. But it has been reported that, so some sources say he applied for parole and that his bid was going to be rejected due to him still being a risk, including reportedly one psychiatric report claiming he was still a, quote, sexual risk to women.
Mm.
But there are other sources that basically say the parole board for Scotland does not comment on individual cases. So it's not clear if he has actually applied, if it's been rejected, what's going on. And since this is literally like a couple of weeks ago that he was able to apply, it's also new and there's just not any information, but there's no clear, like, he applied and was rejected, or he applied and he's waiting. It's kind of unclear right now.
Okay.
Jody was just 14 years old when her life was so senselessly taken. Her family and friends describe her as a ray of sunshine. She was a thoughtful person, with her aunt saying, quote, her thoughtfulness is reflected in her homemade presents and the time and effort she put into them.
So sad.
Jody was also a very private person, as was reflected in her poetry, and her family kind of just wishes for that to be respected.
Yeah.
Rest in peace, Jody. With that, that's all I have for you guys. I think Andrea and I have made kind of clear what we think.
Yeah.
To me, it just doesn't seem like there are any other viable suspects out there. This could be because nobody else was investigated because they believed that Luke Mitchell did it, but it just doesn't seem like there's any evidence to point to there being anyone else involved.
Yeah, but they did invest. I mean,
yeah, they
didn't have any... they didn't have any viable suspects, but they did investigate other people. They investigated this, the drug addict, killer, the drug addict, her family.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't imagine anyone else it could be, you know, like if you have some real evidence, like, please present it to us, because I can remain objective. I can listen to other things and form opinions that way. But based on everything that Haley has laid out for us today, I can't imagine it being anyone but him. And based on what I'm hearing, he doesn't sound like he needs to or is ready to or deserves to be paroled.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. And from all my research, I tried to present all of the points of view, everything that has been said about it. And I don't think that there's any evidence that somebody else did it, and the evidence against him seems very damning. But
yeah, the missing jacket, the missing
knife,
the burning of the whatever it was. I mean, it's just a weird time to burn something.
Yeah, 10:30 at night, and the fact that the mom did that, and then her alibi or her corroboration of his alibi contradicts the brother. I don't know.
She has surgery. Charges and then they get dropped.
A mother, I feel like, is more likely to lie for her son than a brother. I mean,
I'm not going to lie for my kid if he murders someone, but, you know, if it's something else, I might.
Yeah, you know, like it
you want to protect your child. It's your womanly, motherly instinct to protect your child at all costs. And unfortunately, sometimes that gets spilt over into something extreme like this. And
yeah. Whereas a brother, if he's told, like, if you lie under oath, you're going to go to jail, I feel like he's less likely to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah. I would love to hear what you guys think about Mitchell's guilt or innocence. I'm very curious if anyone has, like, other opinions or other thoughts. And thank you again to Emma for suggesting this case, because it was a very interesting one. I'm glad I got to tell Jody's story. And yeah, I hope you guys can join me in remembering Jody for the seemingly bright, amazing human that she was.
Whose life was ripped away way, way, way too early.
So she was so young and had so much life ahead of her. 14. But that is all I have for you guys today. Thank you so, so much for listening. And until next time, keep it human.
Bye, guys.